Welcome to the Majlis, podcast of the Muslim Society's Global Perspectives Project at Queen's University. Majlis is the Arabic word for an assembly, literally a gathering of people sitting together, and it was used for the sessions of learned scholars, philosophers, intellectuals, and artists brought together to discuss and debate. Our podcast intends to accomplish the same purpose of bringing together experts and scholars for discussion and conversation about the politics, histories, cultures of the Middle East, Islamic world, and Muslim diasporas.
You can find the Majlis on your favorite podcast site, including Spotify and Apple iTunes. Don't forget to subscribe and let us know what you think by giving us a rating.
Hello, salam, bonjour. This is Adnan Hussein, director of the Muslim Society's Global Perspectives Project at Queen's University. Welcome to this episode of The Majlis. I'm really delighted today to be joined by one of the foremost scholars of the relationship between the so-called war on terror and racism and Islamophobia. Dr. Arun Kundnani writes on issues of race, culture, and empire, particularly the concepts of racial capitalism, Islamophobia, and the security and surveillance apparatus. And he's the author of two very important books, The End of Tolerance, Racism in 21st Century Britain from Pluto Press in 2007, and The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror from Verso in 2014. He'll also be giving an online lecture sponsored by MSGP on Tuesday, January 25th, at 4 p.m. Eastern, entitled What Was the War on Terror? It is free and open to the public, so do plan to attend. Arun, it's wonderful to meet you, and thanks for joining us on the Majlis.
Thanks so much for having me, Adnan. Good to be here.
Yeah, well, I have learned a great deal from your book, The Muslims Are Coming, and I've assigned it to students in the course that we designed here at Queen's University on the history of Islamophobia. So I wonder if we might start there with what your key arguments were in The Muslims Are Coming and what you saw as the relationship between the war on terror and manifestations or rationales of Islamophobia.
Yeah, so, you know, I wrote that book really in the aftermath of, at the time I was living in England in the late zeros, whatever you call that zeros, first decade. Yeah. I don't know what's that first decade called? I don't know. But I was living in England, you know, 2007, 2008 in Europe generally around that time. You saw this kind of sweep of anti-Muslim rhetoric across, you know, especially Western Europe. And then I moved to the United States in 2010, and there was a different but related kind of pattern there going on. So the book kind of came out of that, and what it was trying to do was say, look, we actually have at that time there'd been a lot of books and journalism and some academic work about the war on terror as a kind of global project, you know, kind of military project, wars, Guantanamo, extraordinary rendition, and so forth, and looking at describing that and trying to understand where that was coming from and, you know, kind of ideas around that. And at the same time, there'd been an attempt to understand some of the kind of the kind of extreme rhetoric coming from right-wing groups in Europe and the United States, right? Islamophobic rhetoric coming from the right. And it seems to me there was kind of a big piece that was missing from the conversation at the time, which was, one was the question of racism in the war on terror, right? Which seemed to me central. And you can't understand Guantanamo unless you understand that everyone in it is Muslim, and understand that the way that the presence of that particular site of incarceration was being legitimized was through all kinds of images of Muslims that were racialized, right? And understanding that process, and obviously not just about Guantanamo, but about the whole apparatus of the war on terror, not just in in the places where the war on terror was an active military campaign, you know, like in Iraq and Afghanistan, but also, you know, on the streets of Queens, New York, and on the streets of Bradford, England. So that was one thing. And then the other thing was, you know, to understand that when we think about that racism, and the way that it it underpins a kind of structure of violence. It's not, you know, it would be a lot more convenient for us if it was just simply a matter of conservatives or the far right, but it was clear that there was something going on amongst liberals as well. And in fact, arguably, certainly by the time Obama was president, you know, from 2009, when I was writing, I mean, I wrote the book while Obama was president. It was clear that actually the dominant way in which the war on terror and anti-Muslim racism were working was a liberal frame, not a conservative frame, right? The neoconservatives had kind of created the war on terror, but it was the Obama administration that continued it and stabilized it and just made it a normal part of the infrastructure of US imperialism. So, you know, I felt like for those of us who are critics of the war on terror, we were kind of not shooting our guns in the right place, as it were. You know, we were kind of taking the easy low-hanging fruit of the kind of obviously racist conservative rhetoric and missing something a little more subtle that was actually central and was necessary to confront if we were going to kind of have any impact and change any of this. So that was, you know, that was what I was interested in. And it seemed to me central to the idea of, you know, the central concept for me was radicalization, right? That was the concept that had suddenly over the course of the previous decade become this kind of key signifier in the discourse of the war on terror. No one talked about radicalization before kind of 2000. And I mean, 2005 was kind of a key year in the emergence of that discourse. I mean, if there's a handful of people that were talking about radicalization before 2005. So it's not even 9/11, it's 2005, really. 2004, 2005, we can go into why that was. But radicalization after that emerged as this absolutely central term that was not being talked about, really, by those of us who are critical of the war on terror. We weren't really thinking about it. But by looking at that term, it was possible, I argued, to show how the particular form of racism bound up with, you know, anti-Muslim racism, how that worked through the concept of radicalization, and also to show the kind of way in which liberals were bound up in that racialization process as well. Because it's really through that idea of radicalization that happened. But what was, you know, what I argued was that the term radicalization had been conjured to describe a process by which the good Muslim becomes the bad Muslim. Mm-hmm. Right? A central idea to the war on terror was the distinction between the good Muslim and the bad Muslim. If, you know, to use Mahmoud Mamdani's, I mean, his book was, I think, excellent in kind of helping me to think through a lot of this stuff initially. And so the good Muslim, bad Muslim division is there. What radicalization does is it says, this is the process by which someone goes from being a good Muslim to a bad Muslim. Once you understand that, then, you know, within this whole discourse of radicalization and within all the kind of security apparatuses, the intelligence agencies, the police agencies, the think tanks, et cetera, you know, which all set up a system of surveillance to then track this process of radicalization. Who is trans, you know, which particular communities, which particular individuals, which particular ideologies are involved in this transformation from the good Muslim to the bad Muslim? And how can we reverse that? And how can we prevent that? You know, so this sets up this whole structure. And the book is really looking at that structure and what it means for ordinary Muslims, especially in the United States and in the United Kingdom, how that translates then down into, you know, the in the UK, things like the Prevent policy, which was, you know, the very elaborate counter-radicalization policy that had been introduced by the Tony Blair government and continues to this day, and involves a quite incredible system of surveillance underpinned by this totally bogus idea that there are indicators that you can identify that tell you when someone is radicalizing, and then you can try and spot that and prevent it. And then in the United States, you know, the main way really that radicalization was then operationalized in policy terms was with the FBI's program of entrapment. You know, to this day, there are hundreds and hundreds of Muslims in federal prisons in the United States who are there because they were entrapped in totally bogus ways by the FBI in that period from around about 2004 to well, it continues, but certainly the heyday was 2004 to 2015 or so.
Yeah, well, that's very interesting. It does seem like the radicalization theory is what made it or facilitated this to be incorporated by liberal, you know, by liberal policies and liberal politics, because that was something that could distinguish it from the more broad spectrum civilizational conflict, or all Muslims are, you know, culturally or racially other and inimical. One other dimension of this, it seems, and this often comes up in discussing Islamophobia, is that relationship between kind of political, religious ideology and race that you've mentioned. And I'm wondering if maybe you can talk a little bit more about that, because obviously the more civilizational Huntingtonian or far right approach was simply to see, as I just mentioned, and as you were alluding to, you know, Muslims as entirely unassimilable into the norms of Western society and culture, and had to be, at the very least, expunged domestically, or converted, or, you know, something had to be done. There was a Muslim problem domestically in kind of multicultural, multi-religious societies of Europe and North America, or Australia and New Zealand, these sorts of places, and a problem globally in terms of global affairs. And one thing I very much liked about your analysis was looking at how and why those had to be brought together. So there's a lot to unpack there, but I'm wondering if we might start with that question of the Muslim as a problem, and under what terms, you know, racial versus political ideology, and how these two were kind of connected, before we maybe pursue a little bit more about how the liberals managed to distinguish their own approach to this.
Right. So this is complicated here, right? So, you know, I think one of the starting points is to say, look, especially in the United States, I imagine also in Canada, that we have a tendency to think of questions of race in terms of a black-white dualism, right? So and by implication, it's a color issue, a skin color issue, right? If you look at the history of racism, you know, I think you'll see that is just one particular aspect of it. Especially in the history of European colonialism, that kind of color racism sits alongside racism that can operate in all kinds of other ways. One of those ways is through fixing an idea of culture, right? So what I mean is we see in the history of European colonialism in Africa and Asia, in the Middle East, other places, a constant tendency to begin to occupy other people's countries, essentially for fairly straightforward economic reasons, right? It's about resources. It's about wanting to control those resources. At some point, people rise up against that, right? People don't want their countries occupied, so they rise up against that. At that point, what you see is a kind of a moment of reflection by the colonizers. This pattern repeats itself through the history. A moment of reflection by the colonizer, where they try to make sense of what's going on. But because they're colonizers, they can't directly confront what's really going on, which is they're involved in appropriation of other people's resources, and those people engage in a political opposition to that. Typically, what they do is they displace the political conflict between themselves and the people they're colonizing onto the train of culture. And what that means is they start to say to themselves, it's not the problem is not that we're doing something that people object to politically. It's that their culture prevents them from appreciating the civilizing and modernizing mission that we're engaged in on their behalf, right? So there is a problem of their culture rather than our politics, as it were, right? Their cultural values, right, are ill-adapted to modernity, right? But that, you know, that's what you see in Africa. That's what you see in India repeatedly, blah, 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 right? You know, the key moment in the history of British colonialism in India for this is 1857, when you get the, you know, the uprising against the East India Company and its colonizing. And that's when you start to get this discourse around culture emerge in the Indian context, the British colonial context in India, right? In other places, it happens in other times. So what happens in, really, you know, the idea of that being repeated in the case of Muslims as a problem is something that you see, I would argue, from the late 1960s, right? Now, when we talk about the idea of a Muslim problem, that is not to say that before then, people who were Muslims were not perceived in racialized ways, either as under other categories, Arab, you know, or other categories of ethnicity or race that might be that might coincide with people who are Muslim as well, but
like Asians in
right
UK, right, yeah,
right, exactly, right. But the idea that there is something specifically about Islam, right, Muslimness in itself. In the United States context, that's something that you see come about really from the late 1960s in the kind of sustained way that we're familiar with now. Before then, you don't see it. Obviously, you can find all kinds of people who have bad things to say about Islam throughout the history of the United States. In the European colonial context, there are moments, you know, if you go back to read what the British colonialists were saying when they were confronted with the uprising in Sudan, you know, in the late 19th century against the British presence there, you know, the discourse was, you know, in some ways you can see the same terminology being applied then to that resistance, to what you would see in the war on terror. You know, they talk about ideas of jihad and ideas of Sharia and so forth, right? The same kind of themes are there. So that's, you know, there is a history there that is then appropriated later. But in the United States, it's really the context is the late 1960s, when the Palestinian struggle shifts from a struggle that's centered on the diplomacy between Arab nation states and Israel and the United States, right? You know, before 1967 war, the Palestinian cause was understood to be something that involved the advocacy of Arab nation states, right? And they didn't get anywhere with that. And then in the 67 war, West Bank and Gaza are militarily occupied, right? And so at that point, the Palestinian cause switches their strategy and they start to operate as an insurgency rather than as a in terms of diplomacy. And that is in the context of actually an upsurge in that kind of insurgent movements across the Third World at the time. But the Palestinian struggle has a particular significance at that time because what's distinctive about it is that whereas most of the world, you know, there's a successful decolonization happening from the 1940s through the 1950s, 60s. In Israel, a very old-fashioned classical kind of settler colonialism is just getting off the ground in the 1940s, right? And winning and continuing to expand and eliminate through the following decades, right? So it symbolizes a massive backwards movement in terms of the struggle against colonialism. That's why the Palestinian struggle resonates and symbolizes so much across the Third World from that moment, right? But in terms of the United States, equally it symbolizes, right? In terms of foreign policy planners in the US, it's, you know, the shift to a very tight alliance of Israel begins after 67. And the Palestinian struggle signifies a kind of fear and anxiety that, you know, that the Third World is not being incorporated into the United States' vision of global capitalism, right? Like through the 50s and early 60s, you can, you know, the United States can look around the world and say, we've got this, you know. By the late 1960s, it can't do that as easily, especially as we get into the 1970s. There's, you know, the Pentagon's talking about 50 different armed insurgencies around the world against the United States. and the Palestinian insurgency is the most symbolic of that. And then you get the 1973 oil embargo, where Saudi Arabia and some of the other Arab oil producing states say that they will stop selling oil to the United States, stop shipping oil to the United States, unless the United States agrees to force Israel to evacuate from the occupied territories, right? So that is a crucial moment because and it gets mixed up in all kinds of ways. But if, you know, and Saudi Arabia is not by any means then or now a leader of third world liberation, of course. But it gets symbolized, right? It resonates in terms of foreign policy. The foreign policy world in DC, in the United States, it becomes symbolic that this is a vulnerability, right? The Palestinian struggle is a vulnerability, and if the broader Arab world stands up for Palestinians, then they can act. You know, what was the effect of that? It was to hold the whole world economy to ransom, because the whole world economy depended on the supply of oil, essentially, and Saudi Arabia was the key, you know, the main supplier, and caused the crisis of the dollar, et cetera, massive challenge. So from that moment on, really, there is a Muslim problem. That's the moment from 1973 when, if you read, like an establishment foreign policy journal like Foreign Affairs, it's from that moment that you start to see contributions that say, what is Sharia law? Mm-hmm. What is jihad? You start to get that kind of thing that now seems very familiar to us of Western foreign policy figures wanting to become experts on Islam, understood as this kind of body of traditional values. And then the question posed from that moment in 1973 on the pages of Foreign Affairs and other journals like it, is this compatible with modernity, which is a kind of code. Again, it's a cultural discussion, right? Is this cultural thing called Islam compatible with this cultural thing called Western modernity? Right. Yes or no? We can have pages and pages and pages of really tedious discussions about that. But that is a displaced discourse that is fundamentally about the political question, will we be able to impose our will on these people who seem to be opposing it, right? But we never present the conversation in those terms, because that would then raise the question of, well, by what legitimacy can we in this part of the world impose our will on them in that part of the world? And that becomes a harder question to answer than the question of, let's have this conversation about clashing or shared values, right? Yes. So that's the picture. Then, that's kind of then bubbling along, that kind of conversation amongst, and it's not actually a mass media conversation at that point. It's a private conversation, really, amongst foreign policy people. Yes, the oil crisis has generated this image of the Arab oil sheikh who can hold the world economy to ransom. But it's not a major thing. It's a part of a much bigger set of stories around the Cold War and so forth. Right. It's really in the 90s then that we get the full flow of the anti-Muslim racism that we now live with, which is and this really comes from a kind of idea that, again, in the United States context, it's centered on the question of Israel and Palestine, actually, right? So the question in the 90s is in terms of the foreign policy world of the United States is, are we living in a end of history, or are we living in the clash of civilizations, right? So the end of history is the idea that comes from Francis Fukuyama, that basically with the end of communism from 1991, the whole world now is going to basically tend towards some kind of liberal democratic capitalist societies, and the United States has won the Cold War, and now we're kind of over with these big ideological clashes. And then the kind of counterview coming from Samuel Huntington is that there's going to be, instead of political ideology clashing, there's going to be cultures clashing, right? The clash of civilizations. For him, civilization means culture, cultural values, and that these are, so in his view, culture is something that is deeply rooted. For me, culture is dynamic, right? Like it flows, it moves, and it changes. And it changes in step with political and economic and social changes all the time. There is no pure culture, actually. Cultures are always mixed and interacting with each other, right? But for Samuel Huntington, you can divide up the world's populations into these different cultural blocks that, of course, look very much like the 19th century racial divisions that would have talked about race instead of culture. You know, and we can look at the way in which through the 20th century, fixed ideas of culture, which ironically were originally mobilized to challenge the kind of Nazi-style racism of the mid-20th century, end up being used to kind of create a new cultural racism that Huntington represents, right? And so you divide up the world in this way, and then you say, well, when we look at the world divided up in this way, there is, you know, one or two cultures in particular that stand out as antagonistic to the West. And one of those is Islam, the other is China, right? And so it means that for him, you can predict that there are inevitably going to be conflicts between the West and Islam, and we better prepare for that, right? Again, you know, the context for this is really the question of Palestine again, because in the, you know, what happens in the 1990s, if we put it in more realistic terms rather than just the end of history, what happens in the 1990s is the US has successfully defeated all the major kind of forces that were opposed to the kind of US model of Western capitalism, right? Which were significant, at least, let's say, in the late 60s through the 70s. But by the 90s had been defeated. So the US had a kind of political success. Even the African National Congress in South Africa, after it wins power in 1994, chooses a neoliberal kind of economic policy, right? That signifies the extent of this success of the kind of US vision for the world. The one kind of movement that is holding out for something different is the Palestinian struggle. Right. The Oslo process is meant to be the process in the 90s that integrates the Palestinian movement into the global system in the same way that the ANC had been integrated in South Africa. But actually, it's not successful. Right. Yes, the leadership go along with it, but the majority of the Palestinian people do not. And they make that clear. And so the anxiety that generates is the anxiety that, well, maybe this system that we're trying to get established is not universal. It can't be made universal because it oppresses too many people. It generates too much opposition, and it's going to unravel, and we're going to have to confront the fact that people don't want it. If you can get to the point where everyone signed up to it, you can convince yourself that that's never going to happen. But the Palestinians basically force us to say no. There is going to be opposition, right? And when everyone else has stopped fighting, they're still fighting. Now, there's a lot more people fighting, and the world looks very different from how it did in this weird kind of decade of the 1990s when, you know, I think of it like the TV show Friends, where you know, we imagine that the world can be this place where economic problems do not exist. We can just be comfortable without, you know, really needing to think about
New York apartments.
Right. We can live in this apartment without having to ever ask the question of where does the money come to pay for this? And we will get along basically fine, and we're all happy and cozy, and we're all white, and everything else is erased, right? And so, you know, that was the 1990s, right? That show came out then. I mean, I think it reflects the ideology of the time. And the Palestinians are banging on the door of that apartment saying, hey, you know, we're still struggling. Right. So the US foreign policy establishment today still has this fantasy that it can live in the 1990s forever. Right. But the world is moving on, thank God.
Yeah. I mean, actually, this, you know, does remind me a little bit of the political scientists who started to recognize that just declaring victory, that globalization of neoliberal capitalism was now going to dominate. When they started recognizing there might be some problems, they did characterize it principally as a clash or as a contest or struggle between, you know, Mick World and Jihad, right? The famous book by Benjamin Barber, Jihad versus Mick World.
Right.
And actually, Timothy Mitchell wrote a wonderful, I think in Social Text, response to this kind of way of thinking called Mick Jihad, which I think, of course, also is the other side of it, that, you know, when the Cold War was not completely won, you know, Islam was mobilized as a tool for, you know, confronting and defeating, you know, left visions and movements in the third world, you know, particularly in the Middle East Islamic world. But once that was accomplished, it had sort of opened up the possibility. So on the one hand, it could be a tool in the arsenal of racial capitalism, you know, against, you know, the Soviet Union and communism. But then it quickly also moved, I think, you know, mainly under the auspices of the Iranian Revolution, you know, representing an anti-imperialist sort of national project in terms of global Islamic values. This could seamlessly move into that as the threat in that Huntingtonian vision of Islamic civilization.
Right.
Yeah.
And Huntington, so people like Huntington and neoconservatives are, you know, if you read their stuff over the years, they're not hiding what they're doing, right? It's like, it's all spelled out. They will say explicitly, we need an enemy. Right. I mean, yes. The United States needs an enemy. And what are the candidates after the end of communism? Well, you know, for Huntington, Islam is a great candidate because it's, you know, seen as racially other, as he puts it. And, you know, is possible to imagine it as this kind of force that's threatening the world. Right. And they are, you know, the neoconservatism is a political philosophy that is based on lying to people because it says, you know, you need to have a noble, what they call a noble lie, to, in which you create an external enemy to unite people in your nation, right? That, you know, I mean, I find that you know, to be less central to what's going on actually than the liberals who then respond to that challenge from conservatives, right, who then say, you're being unfair on Islam. Islam is not this one monolith, but Islam actually consists of people who are extremists, but also people who are moderates, right? And the liberal argument is how can we intervene in this cultural space of Islam to favor the moderates against the extremists? And how can we mobilize the moderates again? And that is actually the more, in terms of the political power of these different discourses, that one is the one to that is more dominant and the one that we need to understand more clearly. And that, you know, that's where the ideas of radicalization come in. What it does is it shares with the neoconservative view actually the same fundamental idea that the problem is culture, right? But then it has a different view of how to understand that problem. It sees culture as malleable rather than fixed, right? But malleable through, you know, kind of external manipulation by great powers, not as something that itself is living amongst a people and has its own kind of energy and own kind of dynamism, but something that has to be manipulated by powerful forces in the West, in the interest of the kind of global system.
Right. And so that's also where radicalization theory gains its matter to operate on, as it were, is that, okay, if there are distinctions to be made, how do we understand the consequences of these distinctions and how do we intervene effectively in such a way to prevent the movement from moderate to extreme or from, you know, one form of political ideology or cultural identification to a more so-called radical one. And that seems to be also where, you know, I mean, it's interesting because these debates, it's really hearkening back to that, you know, that period where, you know, there were some who were like, well, we don't know what's going on. It's hard for us to know. And one of the response, you know, how to distinguish between Muslims and, you know, there was just so much confusion. And so the really right wing and militarist and violent response was like, you know, they're all a problem. Mm-hmm. So let's not beat ourselves up about this whole, you know, question.
Right.
Let's direct our energies outwards in this confrontation, this struggle from which, you know, we will derive, you know, also a kind of renovation. And this is something I do want to talk a little bit more as well, perhaps later, mm-hmm. some kind of renovation of our project, you know, that has kind of languished under neoliberalism, but now we can reclaim some meaning in history because we're going to be involved in this grand global mm-hmm. struggle to resuscitate the West and capitalism and so on. But, you know, those who saw that as a problem that could that was insurmountable that way, or also had these, you know, ideas about diversity and cultural distinctions, and you know, liked nuance and wanted to, you know, be able to have the more calibrated understanding, they could look to radicalization theory as an effective alternative to just violent military intervention and the mm-hmm. huge and profound costs that, you know, were involved in that kind of an effort. So it kind of made it more manageable in some ways, and then created, as I think you point out in your book and others have been studying, this huge industry mm-hmm. That integrates academia, all kinds of new institutes, think tanks, and the security establishment, security and surveillance establishment. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the way in which, because usually they will deny that race plays any role, you know, in this. So how do you see the racial component of the functioning of radicalization theory and its adoption and implementation by the security and surveillance establishment?
Yeah, so there's two things to say on that, right? And it's again, I don't think there's a simple kind of answer to that. There's some complications here. But firstly, in terms of like how it's implemented, right? It's kind of easier to see. So if you think about something like the Prevent policy in Britain, which was the counter-radicalization policy introduced by the Tony Blair government, from kind of around about 2006 or so. What it's doing is saying, we have all our terrorism acts and our various laws that criminalize acts of terrorism, but we need to be able to identify people who are becoming terrorists before they are actually involved in criminal activity that we can then arrest them for and prosecute. Right, so it's this idea that in the jargon, there's a pre-criminal space, right? Someone who's going to commit a crime in the future but hasn't done so yet, and that might be about individuals, but it might also be about communities as a whole generating extremism and terrorism, right? So, what kind of policy is going to address that? Well, the prevent policy is aimed at that, and what it's doing is saying, we have a theory as to what causes terrorism. And that theory is that essentially some kind of religious and political ideology is what causes terrorism. And we can talk about the characteristics of that religious and political ideology, you know, and within this space of kind of radicalization policy, people will have these discussions about how to define that. And of course, that's never settled. But the underlying point is that some kind of religious or political ideology causes people to become terrorists. So if you want to prevent terrorism, you have to prevent that ideology from circulating. Okay. To some extent, you can do that through criminalization, but to a large extent, because in a country like Britain, you can't just ban ideas directly and openly. To some extent, it has to be done through other kinds of non-criminal intervention. And this is where liberals come into their own, because this is where you can then create a whole infrastructure that says, we're not trying to arrest you. We're not trying to criminalize you. We're trying to foster right. You know, we're trying to promote shared values would be one way of putting it, right? Like in the jargon here, we're trying to promote shared values. And we're trying to promote integration, and we're trying to promote an idea of modern Britain, whatever it is, right? And what that means is one, a system of surveillance to try and identify where you think this dangerous ideology is circulating, and then two, interventions to then stop it from circulating. So that could be in terms of individuals, you know, like mentoring, engaging that individual to challenge their views in one way or another. In terms of community, it could be, you know, funding particular religious leaders or community leaders to promote the message that you want promoted in the community, and seeking to undermine others who are promoting opposing messages by, you know, in various ways, right? Without simply arresting them. So, you know, so all of that is what was going on with Prevent. You know, huge amounts of money being poured into Muslim communities in Britain to, if they could persuade the funding agencies and the government that they were part of this project of promoting a moderate Islam, right? How does that become a racial project? Well, it starts by saying that the only problem of what they're calling radicalization is only there in Muslim communities. It's not there in any other community, right? So, you know, the way this policy was rolled out in Britain was literally the funding was allocated in proportion to the number of Muslims in each different local authority area enumerated by the 2001 census, which was the first to ask the question of what your religion is. And so they could literally say, okay, in this, you know, of the 500 local authority areas, you know, if you have 2,000 Muslims living there, you get this amount of funding. If you have 4,000 Muslims living there, you get double the number of funding, and so on, right? And that funding might seem like a gift to the community, but it's actually funding to try and manipulate that community ideologically and culturally to what the government perceives to be the correct version of Islam that is supposed to be promoted. Then think of all the training that then goes on under this as well. So if your project is to identify the, you know, a lot of this focused on teenagers, right? If your agenda is to identify who are the teenagers, the Muslim teenagers, not any other kinds of teenager, the Muslim teenagers who are radicalizing. Well, in a country like Britain, what you do is you recruit all the people who are engaging with Muslim teenagers in the various public services, teachers, youth workers, doctors, and so on. And you give them training in how to spot what you think are the signs, the indicators that someone is radicalizing to this dangerous ideology. And so that means training, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in a certain idea of young Muslims as a problem, as a risk that it's your responsibility to surveil and track on behalf of the security state. That's what, you know, we rolled out that training in Britain over a decade or so, and basically taught hundreds of thousands of public sector workers in Britain how to be Islamophobes. Now, you can see the same kinds of policies in Holland, in Canada, in the United States, in Sweden. You know, these policies traveled around those countries in Northwestern Europe and North America, and then actually in different forms have been exported globally, right? Now, in the US case, you know, the US counter-radicalization model was one in which, because the US has a different way of thinking about the role of religion in public life, and it has a different way of thinking about public services, the British model didn't quite translate to the United States. So what they did instead was to say, well, we can't arrest someone for their ideas, right? We can't arrest someone because they're visiting, you know, because they're posting ideas online, because they will have a First Amendment defense. But what we can do is say, well, what if we identify those people who are who seem to have this set of ideas that we think is a problem, and what if we then use the powers of the FBI to see if we can criminalize them by putting circumstances in their lives in which they are then engineered to commit something that can be then prosecuted in court, right? So you put informants in someone's life, and you use, you know, huge resources that the FBI has to bring about the prosecution that you want. Or if that person is a foreign national, you deport them. If you have some other way of prosecuting them for something completely unrelated to terrorism, you prioritize that and so on, right? So you're actually using, whereas the counter-radicalization space is normally characterized as a kind of space of soft power, here it's hard power, right? And so obviously then you have this machinery of criminalization rolling out, targeting a particular community. And of course, you know, when you look at the documents that define this approach that come from the FBI, or whether it comes from, you know, police departments like the New York Police Department, you know, you can see the racism very clearly in these documents. You know, New York Police Department radicalization document, clearly is creating this idea of Muslims that the more Islamic you are, the more of a terrorist you're likely to be, right? It's as crude as that. And every Muslim is a suspect, right? If not a terrorist now, they're a suspect that they might be in the future. And of course, that has all kinds of effects when you then train huge numbers of FBI agents and police department officers in that reasoning. That's what racial profiling looks like. Right. Now, then come back to the kind of the question of racism at the more conceptual level and radicalization. Because the idea of radicalization is about starting from a certain kind of fixed idea of culture and then saying, how can we manipulate that idea of culture from the outside? It doesn't, you know, you're still essentially operating within this conservative idea of cultures as these fixed things that determine everything about our lives. It's kind of underlying substrate to who we are. In the same way that Huntington uses it in this way that is essentially analogous to race, it works as a kind of racism. That idea that there's something in us that makes us do everything we do, and that thing is called culture, and that defines who we are. And it's kind of an inheritance that isn't something that's living and shifting and interacting, but it's something that's just there as this force inside us that determines us in a mechanical way. That's essentially what racism is. It's a way of dehistoricizing and naturalizing our ethnicity, our race, our nationality, our religion, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really helpful in understanding how what seem like neutral techniques, well, they don't really seem like neutral techniques, but as techniques of, you know, police surveillance and law enforcement and, these institutions and their practices, how they do end up having racial consequences and are built upon racial assumptions and foundations through this transmutation of culture into race in some ways. But I'm wondering now, you know, this is from those 2000s and early teens or mid-teens. Since that time, with the rise of the far right, both domestically, you might say, with the Trump phenomenon, but globally speaking, around the world, but also some obvious examples in Europe with the emergence of an electoral strength of far right parties in Germany, France, and of course, of far right governments in places like Hungary and so on. A sense that this is a great challenge potentially to the liberal and neoliberal order as well. And now we're seeing some discourses around extremism in white identity politics, white nationalism, and so on, and identifying the far right, or at least portions of the far right, as extremes that where radicalization theory is also, it seems, being applied. How do you analyze that? And has there been some kind of a shift, or is it one of these cases that, you know, the genie is out of the bottle? You know, if you develop it, even if it's in racial terms that are built on some kind of white supremacist sort of assumptions through the state, if it's built up, it can still be used in a variety of different contexts. How do you notice the progress of this? I mean, obviously, one point to say about it is that it wasn't just a Muslim's problem, is that it has now become the undermining of rights, subjecting people to surveillance and targeting in various ways, has consequences beyond Muslims. But what do you think about this turn towards applying some of the same kinds of conceptual apparatus, techniques, and practices, at least nominally, to this emerging far-right threat?
Well, look, I think the first thing is to just go back to kind of basics on this term radicalization, right? Which is the key thing here is that the whole idea of radicalization is flawed, because what the idea does is it says that what causes terrorism is some kind of political or religious ideology, right? And obviously, political and religious ideologies can be relevant, but to think of, essentially terrorism is a political tactic, and all kinds of different groups use it, and people who carry out acts of political violence may or may not be wrapped up in some kind of ideology. And even if they are, it's typically not the thing that's turned them into someone willing to use political violence. It's a political story, right? Not an ideological story. It's not about the ideas in someone's head. Someone doesn't read something and become a terrorist. Someone's made into a terrorist by a whole political history. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the first thing to say. Over the course of the war on terror, millions of pounds and dollars and euros were spent by think tanks, university departments, intelligence agencies to try and find some kind of empirical evidence that some set of ideas, some ideology could correlate in a convincing way with acts of violence. And they never found it, right? Despite all those resources. And so the more serious academics by the end of that period, broke away from the radicalization theory and started to become critics of it. So the radicalization theory should have died, it should have died at birth, but it should have died 10 years in. What happened was, as you say, is that in the last few years, it's kind of been revived to be a kind of a way of talking about, a kind of a way for liberals to talk about the far right, mm-hmm. Okay? I don't think that what we're seeing is the same kind of investment in that as what we saw, sort of in the late 2000s. There is very little resources being put into so-called counter-radicalization of the far right. Right. Whether you look in the United States or Canada or Western Europe, it's very slim, right? It's more about a certain kind of vocabulary, and that does two things. One is it gives this goes way back, actually. It goes way back before the kind of upsurge recently, since 2016. There was always this thing of saying, well, we're tackling the far right as well, and that became the kind of fig leaf to really really direct the large bulk of your resources, right, to counter radicalization amongst Muslims, right? And so you can have a couple of little projects on the side tackling the far right, but in the most superficial way, and of course the model that emerged in relation to Muslim communities is simply not transferable to the far right, for the simple reason that like the model in terms of Muslims is there is a Muslim community that generates a problem and we need to intervene in that community as a whole. Well, what's the community that generates the problem of far right racism, right? Are you going to have counter radicalize all of the world's white people? Because that's not going to, that's not going to happen, right? So what tended to happen was that you would get these little projects here and there that would say, we're working with people who've been convicted of some kind of racist violence, or we're making a DVD about racism or whatever, like that, mm-hmm. superficial stuff, right?
Yeah.
And so what's happened in the last few years is that the, essentially in the United States, is an effect of what happened with Trump in the White House, is, you know, some elements within the national security agencies, like, you know, within the FBI and so forth, understood that there was a way that they could mobilize the idea of radicalization of the far right in order to win new kinds of legislation, new powers, new resources for a threat that was perceived to be coming from the far right. But two things here, right? One is, firstly, those resources and powers mobilized in the name of tackling the far right are much more likely to be used against all kinds of other people, right? So, you know, so the powers, once those powers are on the book, they're more likely to be used against, you know, black movements, Muslims, environmentalists, et cetera, than they are to be used against the far right. Because the far right are politically protected to a large extent, right? It's hard to, you know, Carl Rittenhouse being acquitted, you know, because they have a large amount of political support. So you know, even that's not a case of someone radicalizing. That's a case of someone who goes out and kills people, you know, on video, and he's walking free, right? Celebrated as a hero by conservatives, right, at their conferences. So that tells, you know, we're dealing with something completely different here, right? Secondly, the liberals who mobilize this idea of radicalization, what they're doing is they're fundamentally misunderstanding the problem that we're up against, right? Because there is obviously a problem, right? It's not a fantasy. There is a problem of the far right in the United States, in Europe, right? And what you have in the United States is you know, huge numbers of people involved in militia groups with a far right politics, engaged in, you know, kind of an ongoing process of intimidation of the democratic process, essentially, right? It's we're talking about a huge number of people here. Like probably 100,000 people who are armed members of these groups, right? Now, you can't tackle that problem through criminalization, right? Like, you're not going to arrest 100,000 people with guns in the United States, right? The FBI isn't going to do that. So what you're going to do is you're going to put these new powers on the books, and that's going to make everyone feel good about the fact that it seems like we're tackling white supremacy, right? This is how they describe what they're doing. And then you're going to arrest some people, a tiny fraction of the people who are part of this problem, right? And you're also narrowing the whole question of white supremacy to this thing of like a few neo-Nazis and so-called patriots, rather than thinking of it as a structural and institutional problem across the United States and across the footprint of the United States globally, right? All of that is erased. You're going to impose this language that comes from the war on terror of radicalization and extremism and terrorism onto the problem of white supremacists, right? And thereby, take away from all the people who've lived through these problems for years and have fought against these problems for years, all the racialized groups that have been victimized by white supremacy, all the groups that have tried to mobilize against it, the anti-fascist movements. You're taking from that whole history, you're kind of squashing that whole history and instead imposing this other language, this bureaucratic language of radicalization and extremism, and saying, this is how we're going to understand this problem now, right? And you're not tackling the basic problem here, which is that the United States, in its very constitution, has defined the Second Amendment as a protection for white settler colonial violence.
Right.
Right. Unless you're going to talk about that, mm-hmm. you arrest any number of people you want, right? You're not going to deal with the problem here. And unless we deal with the problem, you know, we are, the space for progressive change, even quite limited progressive change in the United States, is narrow because these guys are out there with guns, willing to intimidate, even the most limited attempt to make progressive change in the United States, right? Mm-hmm. So, ironically, the scaremongering about the far right from liberals underestimates the real problem, right?
Just as scaremongering about the Muslim terrorist exaggerated
Exactly. You know, exactly.
Problem. Like these are related in some sense. Yes.
Right. Exactly. And in both cases, the problem is disconnected from the issue of states and state violence.
Yes.
Right. That's the fundamental flaw in both on both sides, right, of the analysis. Because you can't understand, you know, if you want to understand why did the 7/7 bombings happen in London, right? You talk about ideology all you want, but at the end of the day, you have to link that event to the, you know, Britain's foreign policy, right? Even someone like Tony Blair admits that now.
Yes.
Right. I mean, there were no incidents of political violence like that in the United Kingdom ever before the Iraq War. Right. And you can, you know, if you know a little about the different Islamic movements in the UK at the time, you know what was going on. You know that, you know, their approach before the Iraq War was that they, you know, they were recruiting in Britain, but they didn't consider there to be an armed struggle in Britain. Right. They considered there to be armed struggles in other parts of the world, obviously, you know, like Chechnya, Bosnia, etc. But in Britain, they didn't none of them considered there to be an armed struggle. And the Iraq War, they changed their view. Right. And they align with Al-Qaeda, right? So you know, that's kind of, in other words, you have to understand the role of state violence and non-state violence in a dialectic with each other. They're interacting with each other continuously, and each is deciding on its strategy in response to what it thinks the other side is doing, right?
Right, and yes,
that's the key.
Indeed. Yeah, indeed. And that has been the critique of US empire, its policies and violence, military involvement abroad, its support for oppressive states that were perpetuating colonial occupation and so on.
Right.
All of that was always from the very start erased from the discourse. And if you brought that in, it was seen as irrelevant. And in fact, actually worse than irrelevant. It was somehow,
it was offensive.
Inimical.
It was offensive. We were apologists.
Offensive.
Right.
That's right. Exactly.
Right. And so, you know, and that was incredibly, I mean, the harm that did, that process of intimidation after 9/11 to intimidate us into not talking about that history, right, was incredibly harmful, because it meant it took years before we could start to really have a serious conversation about, you know, about what the problem was here that was causing that violence and how we might seriously try to bring about some peace, you know. So it was now in the case of the far right, you know, the same thing applies. There is an interaction between these far right groups, whether in Europe or in the United States, and mainstream, ostensibly liberal state violence and state politics. Right. Like what those, you know, what these far right groups are essentially saying, whether it's in Europe or in the United States, is they're saying, and you see this very clearly with, you know, with the Islamophobic far right in Europe, right? All those groups, they quote the official government policies on radicalization. They don't need to, you know, quote their own far right history. They don't have to quote Mussolini or Hitler or anyone. They quote Tony Blair and Emmanuel Macron and Theresa May and say, look, there is a problem with Islam. It's a threat to our nation. It's a threat to our culture. The only disagreement we have with Macron or Theresa May or Boris Johnson is that they don't seem to be doing very much about the problem that they themselves admit. So we're going to take it up ourselves on the streets. Right. That's their essential argument. And so so they're parasitic on the official policies of the war on terror. Right. Like the and yeah, that's exactly the same with Trump. Trump just made explicit what was already implicit in the bipartisan politics that preceded him of the war on terror, the war on drugs, the war on immigration. Right. He just took that stuff. I mean, you know, the wall was already there. You know, half of the border with the US and Mexico already had a wall, right? He's just basically saying, oh, I'm going to, like, make that wall longer, mm-hmm. right? But the Democrats and the Republicans before Trump already built that wall, right? He was just building on what they had already done. So, you know, that's what the liberals are doing is saying they want to imagine that the far right comes out of nowhere. Just like 9/11 was imagined to come out of that blue sky, right? It didn't. It came from a history. The far right come from history, and liberals are implicated in that history, right? That's what we have to confront.
Well, I have to thank you for reminding us of that history. It's been 20 years of the global war on terrorism. Of course, longer histories of colonialism and imperialism that also feed into it. But it's so useful to have this opportunity to reflect back on the movements that have been taking place that help us understand it in the place of Islamophobia and the work that Islamophobia has done in enabling and authorizing this rapid extension of state violence and state power. So I really appreciate it, and I actually encourage everyone to come and attend the talk you'll be giving, What Was the War on Terror, on Tuesday, January 25th at 4 p.m. Link to how you can get the Zoom link and Zoom registration and so on will be in the description of this episode. You've been really generous with your time, and I so much appreciate this conversation. If listeners would like to follow you and your work, how should they do so?
I'm on Twitter, which it's just my name, which is ARUNKUNDNANI.
Terrific. And also, you have a website, kundnani.org, that has some of your publications, and you can find out more about your books and so forth.
Absolutely.
Do check it out. Well, again, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us in the Majlis, a podcast by MSGP. Muslim Society's Global Perspectives, or MSGP, is an initiative at Queen's University dedicated to connecting the complex history of Islamic societies with the contemporary world. You can connect, learn more, and support us by checking out our website, www.queensu.ca/MSGP, and stay up to date with our events by following us on Twitter at MSGPQU and on our Facebook, MSGPQU. You can also follow our YouTube channel, The Majlis.